Hey, Ian, in the next podcast, when we don't have the grown-up around, let's go off tap. And no adult supervision.
Welcome to GCP Bytes, episode number 13 for Friday, the 28th of March, 2025. GCP Bytes is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech, and I'm your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, Italy wants to block all the things. Has your Chromecast broken? Find out why. And what's new in Gemini? Find out in the AI wars. But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-host of the show, Dave Wall. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing good, mate. It was so nice of you to turn up.
Oh, I know. Only 30 minutes late, but I'm here finally. And our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you?
I'm good, mate. Good. 30 minutes or 40 minutes? I don't know.
It's about
7 in the morning here.
I've got about 10 guys have chosen to show up on Thursday morning, right when we need to record the podcast. They're all in the living area, drilling holes and marking things out because all the plastering was done on the
rent. Directing builders.
Directing builders. Now, I'd drawn this all out in a plan. We'd calculated it all out and said, yeah, go ahead. You've got it all in the plan. And, of course, we measured it all out and all dimensions are all wrong. And then, of course, the fairing channel's in the way and it's like, well, we've got to go 50 mil this way and 50 mil that way and blah, 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 blah. And then at the last minute, they go, oh, we need all these special mech switches. Blah, and I'm going, oh, what is all this? And anyway, sent the wife in there. She can go deal with it now.
Yep.
You got top men on the case. Top men.
Anyway, let's get the show done. I'll go in and see him at 9 o'clock and hopefully I haven't screwed everything up. But.
You're going to have holes drilled in the walls and ceilings, and they'll be everywhere that isn't where you wanted them.
Yep. How you been anyway? What's that's my tech adventure anyway. How is it with you guys?
Well, we were just discussing before, and you'll see it in all of the 30 minutes of lead up or 40 minutes of lead up that we've recorded before, but. I got myself a new Lenovo ThinkCenter, like a second-hand one, M910Q. And I've had no end of issues with the Intel wireless card that's in it. So I'll install Linux on it, and it works fine throughout the installation process. The Wi-Fi stays there, and then you boot it into the actual OS after starting it up, and there's no Wi-Fi. It can't see any Wi-Fi networks. The wireless card doesn't work at all, so you have to plug a dongle into it to get it to work. And I've gone through, like, I've tried Fedora, I've tried Ubuntu, I've tried Rocky Linux, I've tried Zorin OS. And I was having a play with Zorin OS because they've just released 17.2 version, which is really cool because now you can run a Windows installer on the Linux machine. And if there's this corresponding package in Flatpak or Snap or their normal repos, it'll say, hey, we've already got this in the normal repo. Do you just want to install that one?
Hey, what's its behavior if it doesn't have it?
Then it just installs the EXE under Wine.
Okay.
So it's got a whole heap of pre-built playbooks in there to install it under Wine. It is really, really cool. And they've got other, like, some gimmicky things as well. One of the things that I sort of looked at and went, yeah, that's not really useful for me. You can control your mouse on your laptop with your phone. And the gyro in your phone, which I think is a bit of a gimmick. And the other thing that I don't like is that they've replaced the default browser with Brave. I'm not a fan of Brave browser. It's got too much other stuff going on in it. I just want the browser to be a browser.
Just crypto shovelware garbage.
Yeah. Like all the crypto nonsense that goes on in it. I'm just not interested. Mm. But apart from that, like the UI in Zorin is slick. It is really, really slick. All the extra bits and pieces that you get with it are really cool, and they don't just have Flatpak or just have Snap. They've got both. So where Fedora will only give you Flatpak and Ubuntu will only give you Snap, Zorin's like, no, we'll have both of them.
Right, it's the Burger King of OS. It's like, you know, have it your way.
and then
Windows installers.
The end of the article was like, hey, you can buy a computer with Xorin already pre-installed because I've got Xorin Pro. And I'm like, I wonder whether this is going to be like your standard System 76 where you're going to pay like $3,000 for a laptop you can buy at Harvey Norman for $500. But no, they've got this laptop with Linux.com, and it's got a whole heap of different spec'd laptops on there, and I price one up, and it's about €1,000, which is rough. Let's call it $1,800 Australian, and it's like a Core Ultra 7 with 32 gig of RAM and a 500 gig NVMe drive with Linux pre-installed and a whole heap of customizations to it. I'm like, this is fantastic. I might have to convince the wifey that I'm going to buy one of them.
Yeah, I'm like, well, while we were waiting for Banky, you were looking around on the site. And yeah, you can, I think what is really nice from a, like if you're using them for a business purpose, is that you can get like logos engraved into the lid. You can have like the computer name engraved on the chassis. You can specify like various like Linux configs right from the order checkout. Like, that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Cool. All right. Well, I mean, they look nice. Xorin, that's Xorinos. Yeah, I just had to look it up. Looks nice. I wonder if they're using that NT-Sync business yet. This is apparently
what's
the
that?
Latest.
What's that?
The latest thing the kids are doing. It's gaming enhancements and the latest kernel.
All the kernels that post 5.13, I think it is, or maybe it's 5.7. I can't remember. But I know that Ubuntu was one of the big touts when I was installing Ubuntu on this machine to try and see if the Wi-Fi would work. It was like, oh, you can enable game mode. And I'm like, the hell is game mode?
Mm.
And yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Just
funky.
It prioritizes the game over the top of everything else, essentially.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. There's a couple of videos floating around about it, but yeah, you can get massive performance boosts with video drivers in gaming.
Yeah, cool.
What else we got here, guys? Cloudflare. What's this about Cloudflare?
Oh, yeah, so this is really cool. So Cloudflare, I mean, for years, they've used some pretty novel ways of generating randomness, which is required for a bunch of the security things. They need to use that for entropy. So like ages ago, like they've got their wall in their HQ of lava lamps.
Lava lamps, yeah. Famously, yes.
Yeah, so they've got their wall of lava lamps that they have basically a camera that is like looking at that, and then they pipe that into LavaRand, and then a bunch of their servers then just go and query it to get this seed of for randomness. But they've added different types of generators into their different offices, and their latest one in the their Portugal office in Lisbon is using wave motion machines. You know, the little they're like,
it's like a tipping scale.
Yeah, tipping scale. It's got two different liquids inside, and you kind of tip them one side to the other, and you get to see everything flick through, right? So they wanted something that kind of represented like Portugal and its maritime history, and so they wanted these wave motion machines, but they're not very popular like nowadays, right? And what they needed is a bunch of them in a pretty uniform standard, but also that are designed for 24/7 operation, right? They needed like these, not just like toy ones that they could get on eBay. They needed an industrial wave motion machine. And it's really cool. They actually found a guy, and having, you know, and running like a small business myself, like this is really nice. They found a guy based in the US that specializes in making wave motion machines. He's got his one person business. He's been doing it since 2009. This is Hughes Wave Motion Machines. He started doing this coming out of Lockheed Martin Space Systems. Like, he used to build satellites. And then he's got this little business making wave motion machines, which and they're gorgeous.
And he does.
And they ordered... They ordered 50 of them.
Yeah, yeah. 50
and made
of them.
Their wall. Yeah, made a wall of wave motion machines to get their entropy.
They actually had to do a bunch of like R&D on them as well. It's not just they didn't just take like his standard one. There was a lot of back and forth because they had to actually kind of up-spec them for this particular use case.
Yeah, because a motor wouldn't have been strong enough to just keep that going forever.
Every day.
But I love it. The way it works is like the 50 different machines with 50 different motion wheels and motors, and the containers with this special formula of fluid in them, which is called the Hughes Wave Fluid Formula. Three different colors, blue, green, and orange. It took them 15 months from conception to completion, which is, I mean, for custom built gear, that's pretty quick.
Mm.
It does 14 flips per minute, so over 20,000 a day, and over 15 waves per minute in half a litre of water or liquid per machine. So you can imagine how much random, like if it's taking a snapshot like every tenth of a second even,
mm-hmm.
like you get 10 snapshots a second, you can imagine how much randomness is generated just in one wave machine.
Yeah.
Because the tip is never the same.
Yeah, no, it's purely random. This is not something that you can infer from another solution. Right. And you've got 50 of them as well, so.
Yeah, it's such a cool way of generating random stuff because the random generator on any machine is not random.
No, like it's pseudo. That's right.
It's pseudo-random. That's right. So this is a truly random way of generating randomness. There you go.
So let's see if we can put random in a sentence anymore. Yeah, check it out, and you know, if you want a wave motion machine, go check out Hughes.
Yeah,
cool. All right. Well, what's going on with your PC, Dave?
Oh man. Okay. All right. So, like my main rig, which is a development machine, but it's also like my gaming PC as well, has been sort of struggling for a while. Now it's. What's it? It's a 5800X and a 3080 in it, and no, 90 god gig of RAM. Anyway, I've had it for quite a few years, right? But it's really been starting to struggle, and specifically, like you could hear the fans just thrashing on it, right? And I was having like heat related crashes. If I was doing any gaming, the 3080 was getting too hot and crashing. So. I was like, okay, you know, what do I do? Do I get in there and, like, is it time for a tech refresh? Like, yeah, the CPU's getting a bit old, but I'm actually not that inspired by the CPUs that are available kind of right now. I'm kind of tempted to see if I can skip the whole AM5 generation, right? So this is still, like, at one of the later sort of AM4s. So, you know, if I can kind of skip AM5 altogether and go across to AM6 when it comes out, that would be a win. And so I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe I'm just being a bit lazy. Maybe it just needs a bit of a cleanup. So I popped the side of the case off. And I thought, oh, yeah, there's like a bunch of fan slots that I don't even have fans in. The main heat exhaust fan isn't spinning at all. I'm like, oh, yeah.
Okay.
And then I jump in.
Minor details.
I'm like, oh, man, this is so dusty. I've popped my head side on, got a torch, looking inside all the heat sinks. I'm like, oh, this is pretty bad.
So
bought myself a few new fans. Went and bought myself, I didn't want to get cans of compressed air, and I don't have an air compressor anymore. I had one sort of years ago, but it wasn't great.
Don't bother. Garden blower. Two-stroke garden blower. That's what I do. Take all the fans out, tape down the ones that you can't take out, two-stroke garden blower.
Yeah, only little battery-operated ones. They're
solves
perfect.
It.
They don't produce enough air to blow components off the board, but they produce enough to get rid of dirt.
Yeah, so I bought myself a DataVac. That was what I was like, okay, I'm going to buy a small, and it's not the battery-operated one. It is actually like mains powered. It's like a heavy-duty like metal body on it, but used that for cleaning it all out. replaced a bunch of the broken fans, fixed everything else, and now it's significantly better. I'm like, okay, well, it's not crashing out while playing old games.
Do you redo your thermal paste as well?
That I didn't do. Yeah, I didn't. It's like I don't have thermal paste on hand, so I was like, I'd have to buy it and do it, and couldn't be bothered. That's my.
I was going to say, when you do redo the thermal paste, you need to video it and put it on YouTube so you can get criticised by everybody out there who's never done it before in their life.
And when you do it, say, this is the exact correct quantity of thermal paste that needs to go on.
The perfect amount.
And everybody has their own system. Yeah. I mean, geez, I used to, like back when I was deep into water cooling and stuff, I know you guys have both water cooled before, but did you ever?
No, I have not.
Oh, haven't you?
No.
Oh, I thought you did. At one point, it was pretty popular to lap your CPU. Where you'd sand down.
Take the top off, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because all the IHSs always have like little curves and stuff to them. So it was a big deal to sand the IHS on your CPU and get it to a nice mirror image and then post that on a forum.
Strip it down to the copper,
which is a completely pointless thing to do because you're reducing the surface area on the heatsink.
Well, it was
the
heatsink's
got those little tiny brush marks in it to increase the surface area so that you get more surface area on the thermal paste that makes more content. Does more heat transfer.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's the whole idea of it.
There you go. No, I didn't have to go that deep this time around. So yes, at least hopefully if I can get another 12 months out of it, great.
Yeah. You could probably just get a 50 series card, chuck it in there and you'll get more than 12 months out of it.
Well, yeah, but it's the CPU that's holding me back more than anything.
Okay.
That's my little thing, just actually trying to get the house in order.
And then, Ian, I think you had some Google news going on here. What's this? Just before we get into the community news.
Google's released so much stuff of late. It's phenomenal. So the new Google Cloud Developer Center has been released. cloud.google.com/developers. Super cool little site that has learning opportunities there for every different track. So for data engineers, cloud architects, data professionals, and developer use cases. Really cool bit of kit. If you haven't seen it, jump on, have a look at it, and start doing some of the little courses that are in there. And then the next one I've got is Google Cloud Registry. So GCR. We've been using for donkey's years after a bazillion email notifications that they were killing it. It is finally gone. And I'll reference a really cool article that JK, GDE in Australia, he lives over in Perth, has written about Google Container Registry is dead, long live Artifact Registry. So a couple of key shout-outs here, apart from the fact that, you know, we've been getting notified about GCR being shut down for what feels like years. They've finally done it. Google have provided a tool to transition, and I know we've covered this before. I think we covered it under the previous iteration of this podcast.
Shows you how far back it's been.
Yeah,
right?
it's been ongoing for ages. So Artifact Registry supports more than just Docker. GCR was just a Docker registry, whereas Artifact Registry does containers. It also does like NPM packages. It does your Linux repos. Does a whole heap of stuff. It's really, really cool. But with that, it actually is more expensive than GCR. So Artifact Registry is more expensive by about 3 or 4 times. However, Container Registry wasn't a regional service. It was multi-region, whereas Artifact Registry is regional. So we can put it in Australia Southeast 1, for instance, if you want to keep all of your containers very, very close to your endpoints. So there you go.
Yeah.
Artifact Registry for the win. And if you do jump onto the cloudengineering.substack.com, which is JK's blog, you'll notice there that he does use Gemini to generate the images for the blog, and in it, Container Registry is misspelled. Sorry, JK, I had to call it out, mate.
I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Yeah, AI is really not good with words, is it, in images?
Well, some words I'm sure it's great at, but, you know, when it's trying to convert them to a an image. it sucks. It
just doesn't do
I think I saw Sam Altman posted something the other day talking about like a new part of, you know, OpenAI's image generator. And in the image that he used, the dude has only four fingers. Like, come on, man.
That's gold.
You know, it's the first thing we're going to check.
All right, then. Well, with that out of the way, let's get on with the community news. And being our resident GDE, Ian, you put all these in here today. Take us through them.
I did indeed. Righto. So Melbourne, so the standard GDG meetups are going on. So the ones I found are Melbourne, Brisbane and Sydney. Jump onto Meetup. The links will be in the show notes. Melbourne on the 26th of March. No, that was yesterday. Scratch that one. The Build with AI event is coming up. The Brisbane Mobile Meetup, which is on the day of the show release, so 6 p.m. And then the Cloud Sydney Meetup, which is on the 2nd of April. And then we start the Build with AI events, essentially. So there is lots and lots and lots of workshops and talks going on around Build with AI. The first one I've got here is GDG Sydney. With GDG on campus at UCID, has a Build with AI hands-on workshop, and that's on the 18th of April. So jump onto the meetup channels or jump onto the Google, the GDG community website to have a look at your local GDG and find out when an event is happening around you.
Yeah, they look like fantastic events, and I'll put those links all in the show notes. Of course, you can find them there. Very good. All right. Well, let's get on with the news items. And our first news item this week. Look, this is a bit. This got this is a bit of a comedy show. This one, I thought. Italy demands Google poison DNS under strict privacy shield law. Now, this is not the first time we've sort of seen DNS poisoning to prevent individuals getting to particular websites. But in this case, Italy, and as far as I'm aware from the comments, Spain has a very similar problem. The football, as in the soccer football, and people are probably rolling in their graves hearing me call it that, but the European football has it's big bucks, right? And you know, grabbing a stream and rebroadcasting it is a bit of a problem, and a lot of people do it, and Italy's gone after them and just wants any domain where the football's being restreamed blocked. Of course, that causes problems for other things that are in that domain. And they mentioned a particular case where the Italian ISPs briefly blocked the entire Google Drive domain.
Yeah.
Can't see how that would be an issue.
Not at all.
Oops.
Not at all. Let's just block all the things, mate. Just all of the things can be blocked, and we won't worry about DNS. We'll go underground and do everything by IP.
It won't be a problem if you're blocking stuff like that. No,
not at all. I mean, at the end of the day, people will get around it regardless of what you do.
Exactly.
DNS poisoning is a useless tactic to get rid of access to things because, as is always the case, people will find the site on forums or whatnot and they can just add host files for it or they can get a VPN and go around your DNS.
Have their own DNS entries, use another DNS, use a VPN. There's different ways.
So are they wanting to block it? Because I know, like here in Australia, the ISPs have to block in their own DNS servers. They'll have to block certain, like, piracy websites. They've been doing that for years.
Yeah.
But there was nothing stopping you using, you know, Quad 8 or, you know, Quad 1, whatever you like, really. And then you get the international DNS entries, and that's fine.
Anyway, yeah.
So is that what they're wanting to do? They're wanting to get, you know, Quad 8 to...
Yep. Yeah, Google's public DNS servers, they want that. And they're also hitting up Cloudflare for it as well, so the four ones. But the stupid part about this is that that's not really going to solve their issue, because if people really want to see this stuff, they'll just work their way around it.
Yeah. I mean, I can sympathize with them saying like, hey, we need to do something, right? But what I don't actually know what your real recourse would be, right? The only thing I can see is that, like, if Google doesn't want to remove these from, you know, Quad 8, then what's Italy just going to, they're going to have to ban, like, the ISPs are going to have to ban access to Quad 8? So then you can't use those DNS servers at all?
So in Australia, there are some ISPs, and I don't know whether this is actually mandated or not by the government, but there are some ISPs that capture all traffic to UDP and TCP 53, regardless of what DNS servers you've got set, and they will forward it to their DNS servers.
Right, and then, but if you do DNS over HTTPS...
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's a different story.
Yeah.
And the other side of that is, if you've got a VPN tunnel and you push everything over the VPN tunnel, it doesn't matter what the ISP does, they can't see that traffic anyway.
It's encrypted anyway, yeah.
Yep. So at this point, Google is ignoring the commissioner in Italy and just like, no, we're not doing that, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, so the court threatened, so Cloudflare have got a similar problem, and they're finding that Cloudflare's CDN, like just the entire CDN, DNS servers and Warp VPN were facilitating piracy. So that's it.
Yep.
We've got to block Cloudflare's CDN. We can't use that.
Well, no one uses that, so that's fine.
No one uses that. That won't be a problem. And then the court threatened Cloudflare with fines up to 10,000 euros per day if it did not begin blocking the sites.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Streisand effect as well, right? You block one side, it did 10 pop up.
Yep.
It just doesn't do anything.
It's the same thing that happened with, I don't know, you guys will remember back in the day, Pirate Bay. Like Pirate Bay, the US government would shut down one Pirate Bay server and five more would pop up somewhere else.
Yep. And you get proxies and mirrors and everyone.
Yep.
I mean, it's... Naive. Look, I can't help but think it's naive lawmakers, right? They just don't understand the way this thing works, and think, you know, oh, you block it, done, problem solved. As long as they can't see it on their computer, they think the problem's gone away.
Yeah,
but it hasn't, mate.
The undereducated making rules for those who are far superior in intellect.
It's technically more superior, exactly. Yep. Yeah. So that's interesting. We'll watch how that goes. I think Google's probably finding it just a minor annoyance at the moment and probably really don't care much about it.
I'm guessing that they probably don't care at all.
Mm. All right. Well, moving on. Has your Chromecast been broken? I've got one here in the drawer, I've been meaning to get out and have a go, but Google begs owners of crippled Chromecast not to hit factory reset. Apparently a certificate has expired.
Yep. Yeah, so the certificate expired on the 9th of March. And there's a fix out for it now, but...
There is a fix out now, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was a 10-year-old cert.
It was a long-standing cert. It's the cert that the device uses to pull down updates and all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff. So, you know. But it was a fairly quick fix thing. So on the 9th of March at about 1600 UTC, the certificate expired after 10 years of validity. And then there's a whole heap of Chromecast models, one of mine included, that...
But didn't Google kill off the Chromecast? That's what I don't get.
Yeah. So there's a bit of conspiracy theory going on here that, you know, Google's let this certificate lapse to try and force people to buy the new kit and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, meh. Like, unless I see some evidence of that, I don't believe it.
But anyone could have checked the certificate and seen the expiry date anyway.
That's right.
So, yeah.
But look, Google sometimes
things happen, right? If like you don't have a team working on Chromecast anymore, then any alerts that they may have set to say, "Hey, our cert's expiring," is not going to pop up. So And so it was an intermediary cert that was the one that went out.
Yeah. So it broke the chain. And with all things Google, it expects that the chain is valid all the way up to the root, because that's the core part of security. It's a crazy idea that we should validate every part of the chain. The article goes on to say the chocolate factory, which I find an amusing little quip for Google, discontinued the Chromecast product line last year, replacing it with the Google TV Streamer and quietly winding down support and updates for the line from 2023. Many users still rely on the devices, as evidenced by the ongoing online discussions. While some speculate that issues like the recent certificate authority expiration are deliberate attempts by Google to encourage upgrades, there's no evidence to support this. That's just nonsense. But look, it's not the first time this has happened. The article goes on to say Microsoft had problems in this arena in 2023 with an expired cert rendered cameras on the Surface Pro X unusable. Cisco found itself in the firing line as well.
Yeah, there was also the Let's Encrypt one when they changed out their root cert. And now I was working for a software company at the time when that happened. And I remember we had that outage because a bunch of it was like ancient Ruby like packages that were sitting Ruby on gems. That was super old, like all broke. And I remember that causing a Sev1 outage. And I remember being in the after action review and they're like, "Oh, how come you didn't reissue these certs?" I'm like, "No, but the servers had correct certs. It was inside these little packages that had this ancient stuff." It's like, you haven't updated those packages, which have like these 10.0 CVEs against them. Yeah. So, get your own house in order, mate.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He who's casting stones and all that, yeah.
So the update was on the 13th of March, Google is rolling out, was rolling out an update because, we're more than 10 days past that now, 2 weeks past that, is gradually rolling out an update for Chromecast to get them working again as usual. Problem solved.
Very good.
Easy game.
Because I do like my little Chromecast when I get hotels Chromecast and things, yeah. All right, well, new region. Let's get straight into it. New region in Sweden. IKEA loves it.
Oh, there's so many companies over there that love it.
So does Spotify, yeah.
But it's a 42nd.
42nd global region, yeah.
Yeah, and the 13th region in Europe. Unlucky for some.
Google Cloud launched... Google Cloud launches new region in Sweden, IKEA uses Google Cloud, and they've come out and said Google Cloud's scalable and reliable infrastructure helps us to deliver a seamless shopping experience for our customers, helping us make interior design more accessible to everyone.
Yeah, look, there's been some others as well. So Spotify have come out and said over the past decade we'd forged a valuable partnership with Google Cloud, growing innovation together. The new Google Cloud region in Sweden will be a catalyst for accelerating innovation for Swedish business and digital unicorns. I love that term,
digital unicorns. And, of course, solves the data residency requirements for Sweden as well.
Yeah. One of the interesting bits of this article is that this new region will operate at or above 99% carbon-free of energy during its first full year in operation in 2026. So,
yep. Lots of pumped hydro and nuclear in Sweden, right?
And probably geothermal as well.
Geothermal, yep.
And onshore wind. 700 megawatts of onshore wind projects in the country.
All right, so moving on to something that tickled my fancy a little bit, network security integration. Now, we've been complaining about this for a while, and I'm glad to see that this has come along. What is network security integration? Well, basically, it can intercept. Well, how to summarize it in one sentence? I don't know. It can intercept traffic on a VPC and then do packet inspection. Am I right about that? Is that what I'm seeing here?
Sort of. So there's two different methods of NSI. So there's an out-of-band one where it just mirrors the traffic over to some third-party appliance that does inspection on it and reports. And then there's an in-band where it's sort of a bump-in-the-wire type implementation where it physically reroutes the traffic using Geneve over to the producer network that goes into a next-gen firewall, and then that gets rerouted back into the consumer network and on it goes. So that's the way that you could do IPS, so intrusion prevention. The other one is just intrusion detection.
Yeah. And this is, okay, this is where you see, like, in Google Cloud, how as it's matured, you'll find a lot of, like, developers, they'll be anti this pattern because, oh, it's not the cloud native way of doing, traffic, and this is not how we do things. However, as enterprises have moved up, they want to still keep a lot of their same paradigms. Like, you know, if they're heavily into Palo Alto's, for example, and we see this quite a bit,
yep,
that people are going to be like, yeah, I want to have PAs in between these two servers. I want to have a way to do it. And there has been, you guys have both done architecture diagrams for customers where they've had this requirement, and you have to build some pretty funky things.
Oh, boy.
To make that plumbing go together, it's, and you start introducing points of failure in there because you're not doing it in a cloud-native way, but
that's
it's
right.
To fit a requirement. This lets you have your cake and eat it too.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. This is a far better solution. And AWS has had something similar to this for a little while. I can't remember what it's called. Traffic Gateway, that's it. Yeah. But this is Google's implementation of it. And it means that you can buy a Palo Alto or a
next-gen firewall.
Yeah, next-gen firewall, something like a Fortinet or a Checkpoint or a whole heap of other branded security appliances from the vendor. The vendor runs it in their producer VPC for you, and you connect to it using this tunnel. So essentially it stands up a Geneve tunnel between the consumer and the producer. It intercepts every bit of traffic that comes into that VPC network on the consumer side, pipes it over to the producer network without actually changing anything in the packet, lets the appliance inspect it, and then the appliance pumps it back into the consumer network over that same Geneve tunnel.
Or rejects it if it needs to.
Or rejects it, yeah. So if you're using the in-band version, which is currently in preview, you can do that IDS and IPS in the same thing, versus the out-of-band one is literally just a mirror. So there's like a little interceptor there that mirrors all the traffic over to the producer network, into the appliance, and the appliance can go, hey, this is bad, but I can't do anything about it.
Just so you know, something ain't nice.
Yeah.
But at least you're doing it with the appliance you're familiar with, right? You get the warm fuzzies from
the appliance. You get the warm and fuzzies. You can stand up the Palo Alto log analyzer service and the Palo Alto intrusion detection service and the next gen firewall and read your back pocket of money faster than you can blink.
Well, it still means that your next gen firewall account exec can take you out to lunch, I suppose. Isn't that what it's all about? That's the real business value. 100%.
They've got to buy beers when we're out at lunch too. That's the rules. But it's a really cool little innovation, and there's a whole heap of different partners that they're using at the moment. Some names that we've already mentioned: Palo Alto, Fortinet, Checkpoint, but others that I haven't, like, I've heard of CoreLite, but I haven't heard of Trellix or cPacket, and I have heard of NetScout. So, and as it turns out, Trellix has only been around since 2022, so they're a new player in the field, but. Yeah, they're from look at their website.
Watch someone acquire them for $10 billion.
Yeah. It'll be Google in 5 years' time.
Cool. All right. Well, I'll see how we can integrate that with GCVE.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Traffic flying through it. Yeah, that'd be cool, yeah, because that's desperately needed. All right, then. Well, moving on. Spanner, always been expensive, right? And, you know, a big part of that cost is the SSDs that are required for it. But now we have a new option with HDD storage, which makes it 80% cheaper.
Jeez.
yeah, significantly cheaper, right? So this is going to make it much more accessible to a lot more people. And what's really cool is that it is possible to keep indexes, right? So you can keep your indexes on your SSD and store your actual data on HDD.
Yeah,
so you're kind of getting a hybrid mixed world, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it does storage tiering. So you can set up a storage tiering strategy in Spanner that allows you to move colder data, for want of a better term, onto the spinning Rust and keep all the hot data on the SSDs.
Also, it would be really good for dev environments if you're going to have like you might as well shave some of that cost off of Spanner.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because Spanner is quite costly, just based on the way it works. But this is actually really cool that you can say, rightio, create a locality group. Recent stuff sits on SSDs, and all the spillover past, and the example that they give here in the article is past 15 days spills over to the hard drive.
Yeah, getting best of both worlds, right?
Yep.
Love it. And of course, the Spanner tier storage supports both Google SQL and Postgres SQL dialects, and it is available in all Google Cloud regions where Spanner is available. And you can just use your system insights and check out your HDD and SSD sort of storage amounts.
I need to look up what Google SQL actually looks like, because I've never ever used it.
Oh, it's their modification on it, right?
Yeah.
All right, well, moving on with some security. MyGov. I've got MyGov here. I think it's just My ID now. Well, I say MyGov here in this story. Over 200,000 MyGov users disable passwords in a passkey shift. New figures reveal over 200,000 users of MyGov passwords stopped using passwords in favor of exclusively using passkeys. So the change is happening.
Yeah, so apparently over 20,000 changed in the first week. I'm happy to report that I was one of those because, you know, why not? Mm. But it just does my head in. The passkey project for MyGov or MyID or whatever it's called now cost $5.6 million.
Oh, it's astronomical, isn't it?
But of that, $3.3 million was spent on design, development, implementation, deployment, and testing of the digital capability. So there's another $2.3 million that are somewhere else.
Right, because that includes the implementation.
Yeah.
Mm.
And the testing. So I'm like, where's the other $2.3 million? Like, come on.
Account exec lunches?
Yeah, well, potentially. Government kickbacks? Not that our government would be that corrupt.
It's not the US government.
No.
No. So what's interesting about this is Australia is among the first digital government services in the world to implement passkeys.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got to be a win, right?
Oh, it has to be. Like,
yeah.
It's such a better way of authenticating a user than putting a password in. Passwords Absolutely. Are like 1990s, people. Move with the times.
So, just for a bit of background, passkeys rely on the biometric capabilities of the user's device or a PIN or swipe pattern on the screen. Alternatively, they can be a physical USB device, which I think you guys have got them, don't you?
Yeah.
Your YubiKeys. Inserted or kept close to the device used to sign into MyGov. So if you've got MyID on your phone, your passkey will be your fingerprint. You've got to go through and set it up. And then, bang, you go in. I mean, there's not even a two-factor ping. There's none of that mucking around anymore.
Nope.
Yeah. You're straight in.
And if you use a password manager like 1Password, you know, you can store your pass keys in that because there are two different types of pass keys. There are, you know, single device pass keys and there are shareable pass keys. So then this way, you know, you can actually keep your pass keys in 1Password, and as long as you identify to that, then you can use it on any machine. Mm-hmm. Without having to have a proliferation of passkeys.
Yeah. So Bitwarden supports the same thing. Bitwarden's also got, if you're stuck in, like your provider hasn't implemented passkeys yet, it also stores the one-time authentication tokens in Bitwarden, yep, which allows you to autofill.
Yeah, how much better is doing that? Like, I've still got like a couple that are still in my old Authy, but everything else I've been shipping over to my password manager. It's so much better.
Sadly, Cloudflare is not one of the ones that supports passkeys yet.
Really?
Yep.
I'm genuinely surprised.
Yep, you and me both. For a security company, they're not really up with security yet.
No.
But it'll come. It's not a new technology, but it's a reasonably untested technology as yet. Like, there's lots of people using it, but we haven't really seen how many vulnerabilities there are to it.
Oh, they're trying. You can bet they're trying. Yeah. Speaking of cybersecurity failures, ASIC sues Fig Securities for cybersecurity failures.
That was a fantastic segue, that one.
I'm getting good at them. Yeah, the Australian Securities Watchdog is taking fixed income broker Fig to court, alleging it failed to implement adequate cybersecurity measures over a four-year period, which enabled a hacker to infiltrate its IT network. This doesn't sound good.
No, this was not. This was one of the ones that I found and I was just shaking my head at. So ASIC claims that the deficiencies result in the theft of about 385 gigabytes of confidential data. Around 18,000 clients were notified that their personal information may have been compromised. I love how they word that as it may have been compromised. But the firm was a target of a cyber attack that lasted from May the 19th to June 8th, 2023. But apparently they hadn't implemented the appropriate steps for adequate cyber security risk management plans from March 2019 through to June 2023.
Mm. Ooh, okay. Yeah, that's a long-running failure.
Yeah, that's like that. I'd understand it if you go, hey, it's 6 to 12 months. You put it on the back burner for 6 to 12 months because, you know, you've got competing priorities. But 4 years, that's...
Yeah, someone needed to have a fire lit under them.
Yeah.
Yep. That's blatantly, you know, ignoring the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how it appears. I guess we'll follow that one. 18,000 clients. Yeah, I guess they've got to say maybe a compromise because they probably don't know at this point, right? It's like, yeah, you're one of our clients. You may have been in this data set that went out.
Well, assume that they would know by now. Like the cyber attack was June 8th, 2023. That's nearly 2 years ago. So did they only just become aware of it? Or have they just...
Like they never got the guy out of there. He just got bored and left.
Yeah. He was just like, look, I've had enough of downloading all this data.
I just feel bad. I'm going to let myself
out. I feel
bad
that I'm poning these guys so hard. Said no cyber attacker ever. But I'm concerned that we're only just hearing about this now. Nearly 2 years after the cyber attack had completed.
Yeah. Weren't we supposed to be putting laws in place so that they have got to notify immediately? What's happened to all that?
Yeah, well, that's already been in place since before this attack was in.
Exactly. So, don't know.
Yep.
All right, and of course the big security news of this fortnight is Alphabet to buy Wiz for $32 billion with a B, US.
Yes.
Oh boy.
I'm the whiz.
The biggest acquisition that Google or Alphabet have ever made.
Yeah.
Take that, Mandiant.
Yeah. Oh, well, Mandiant was only I can't remember how much Mandiant was, but it wasn't anything close to this.
5.4 billion.
5.4 is nothing.
Yeah. Nothing. Chicken feed.
And I remember us covering that for ages. It was such a big deal. This is six times larger.
Wow, 30, that's eye-watering.
And this is because they originally rejected one. I think it was like 25 billion or so. And they've come back at 32.
Didn't Google Australia's field CTO, Matthew Zielinski, didn't he go and work for Wiz? Not that long ago? I'm sure he did.
I think you're right, Ian. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. So he's back at Google then.
Back at Google. How the tables
can't
have
get
turned.
Away from the place. How the tables have turned. The conspiracy theorist in me says maybe his move was part of it. It was sort of preconceived as part of this deal.
Yeah, maybe. Who knows? But yeah, this is a huge thing for Google because so the article here says for Google to be able to compete with Microsoft Azure for enterprise customers, it needs to be able to offer a deeper suite of services, including security software. Wiz is that. I do worry though, given such a huge acquisition and such a prominent security provider, whether this will actually get past the US government scrutiny.
Yeah, has it actually been approved yet? It does say in the article, it's high-priced and unusual big breakup fee suggests Alphabet is comfortable that the buy will pass muster with the White House, even as the Trump administration has inserted itself into major deals and promised heavy scrutiny of big tech.
Yeah, so there's another little quote in the article from a lady by the name of Elise Phillips, who's a public policy counsel at Public Knowledge. Says, generally speaking, Google is not a leader in the cloud business and Wiz will still be available on all other cloud services.
Because it is a multi-cloud tool.
Yep. But then Mandiant wants too, wasn't it? Mandiant was a multi-cloud security tooling.
Yeah.
Google has said that Wiz will continue to work with competing cloud platforms.
There you go.
There you go.
Yep.
I think what's interesting, though, is that it was an all-cash transaction as well, not even like a stock swap.
Yeah.
Pure cash.
Yep.
And that slab of cash over. Yeah.
Bring in the semi-trailer load of hundies. Wow. I want to see
that's
the
a
greens.
Road train.
Yep.
All right. Well, with security all done and dusted, let's get on to our favourite part of the show, the AI war. Couple of quickies for the AI Wars this week. We've got Gemma 3, the most capable model you can run on a single GPU or TPU. Now, I've not even tried to run this. Have either of you done that yet?
I haven't run it yet, but I have read a lot about it. It is an absolutely phenomenal model that's not long been released. I think it came out earlier this month, I think it was. So when you have a look at its capability compared to other models around, so you can compare it to like DeepSeek R1 or DeepSeek V3, if you want to look at the DeepSeek side of things, or you can look at Llama, for instance. Gemma is a far more capable model on less compute than all of them combined. Like Gemma will score 1338 in the chatbot arena Elo score on a single GPU, whereas its nearest competitor would be DeepSeek V3, which scores 1318. But it requires 32 GPUs.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It does say, yeah, it outperforms Llama 3, 405B, DeepSeek V3, O3 Mini, in preliminary human preference evaluations on Llama Arena's leaderboard.
Mm.
Yeah, very, very performant. Comes in a couple of different sizes. You've got the 1B, 4B, 12B, and a 27B size.
Yep. Yeah, 27 billion parameters. More parameters are better. But yeah, so out of the box supports 35 languages, and it's pre-trained on over 140. Allows you to build applications and analyze images, text, videos, which gives you the opportunity to do all sorts of really cool stuff. It offers 128,000 token context windows, so it's not the like Gemini 3 Pro 2 million context window or anything, or 10 million context window, whatever it is now.
But that thing runs on more than one GPU. So.
Just a couple more. But it still gives you a really good context window for the amount of GPU it's consuming. And it supports function calling and structured output, which is really cool. I saw a demo at the GDE Summit by one of the Googlers who shows function calling inside a Flutter app calling Gemini. And it's a really cool little tool. And official quantized versions, reducing model size and computational requirements whilst maintaining accuracy. There you go.
Mm. And along with it, we get Shield Gemma 2. It's a 4B image safety checker, and it'll look and check for images that are dangerous, sexually explicit, and violent. I suppose there'd be many applications for that. And it's built on Gemma 3. Cool. All right. Well, the last one for this fortnight and the last one for the AI Wars. And we had a little freak out about this. This is really cool. I've used this a number of times during the week. Gemini now has Canvas.
This is now, so cool.
Yeah.
If you have not gone and used this, you are missing out big time. So you can do a prompt now, and instead of just doing a normal prompt, you click Canvas and it flicks it over into like another panel. And depending on what you're working on, you can preview that. So it'll pull it into like a doc, which is exactly what I did during the week. Or you can ask it to generate some code and it'll pull it into like a code editor and then you can preview it in code, like all within the Gemini window. So cool. It's
just amazingly flexible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and did you see if you generate a doc, you can import that directly into Google Docs?
Yeah.
So create a document file. Yes.
One of the other really cool things that you can do with Gemini is one of the things that we did at the GDE Summit the other weekend was you can get it to create a technical product description. So it'll walk you through how to create it, like what is your product and all this sort of stuff. Like what are you trying to build? And then you can say, "Rightio, show me the steps required to do this," and it'll show you the steps. Like, right, convert that to a list for me, and it will convert it directly to Markdown. That you can paste into anything, and it's literally checkboxes. So
nice.
Really cool bit of kit. The thing that confused me about this article, because I was looking there and I saw the little video thing of it generating code, and I'm like, oh, okay, cool. It generates code. That's fantastic. Righto, so that must be in VS Code. I didn't really pay attention to the video. All I saw was the code bit, and I was like, oh, that looks like VS Code, so it must be in VS Code. And I've been trying to get it to work in VS Code and in Project IDX. It does not work in there. It is purely on the gemini.google.com site.
Yep.
I mean, the code stuff is fun, though. Like, their example is like, hey, help me code like a tic-tac-toe game, right? And it sort of dumps that code out. And then you can preview it and you can actually play it in the browser. On my own side, I was like, hey, make me pretend, right? I need to get a shave. So I was like, okay, I need a web app for my barbershop business to be able to take bookings. And the thing that it spat out, like code, you can flick through, it shows a calendar, available appointments. It pre-generated a bunch of, like, you know, pretend barbers in there so you can see who to book and pricing. And, like, it wasn't even a paragraph worth of prompt that I gave for this thing.
Yeah. It's really cool in what it can do. I'm building a web app at the moment, and one of the things that I haven't done in a lot of years is React. And React has changed so dramatically since I last used it. Back then I was coding with .NET Core 2.1. That gives you an idea of how long ago that was. And I was doing a React PWA, and that was like version 13, I think, of React. And we're at like 17 or 18 now. And I was like, this has all changed. Get Gemini to create something for me so that I can see sort of roughly what it does, and let's go from there.
Mm.
It was an awesome learning tool for me to get my head back into how React works, because I can get it to explain.
This is the thing that the thing I showed you guys, write a web app to play my MP3 files. Mm. It goes through and it gives you a blow-by-blow explanation of what everything's all about. And then right at the end, it gives you how to use this, you know, install Flask, do this, that, and the other, and put the file here, and it'll all run.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And then you can also, this is something that I really enjoy, is that, yes, you have your prompt and, you know, you can see the code and everything there and you can use it. But also, if you then dig into the code and you want to make some changes, or you go, actually, I'm not really happy with this specific block, you can just highlight that inside the preview window and ask it to change some things specifically about that block. You don't have to go back to the original prompt and sort of do it over there. You can say, in this part here, make a change.
Yeah, so when I've just done that. Yeah, so when you do a highlight, it comes up with a little pop-up saying Ask Gemini. You click that and you ask it on that specific thing. Nice.
So this is how I relearned the latest version of React, like the structure of React now, is I got it to generate, like, okay, generate me a three-page PWA that does like a to-do list, right? It does like the list view, it does a detail view, and it has a form in it. It's a fairly simple thing, but it's a good explanation of the three main parts of it. And then you just go through each function that it generates and it's like, right, explain this to me. And it explains every bit of it. Like, this is fantastic. I love it. We did have lots of conversations about Gemini at the GDE summit, and one of the interesting outtakes from that is that most of the engineering style or development managers, development team leaders that are GDEs, don't let their juniors play with AI code generation. And the reason for that is because there's a lot of evidence that juniors don't learn how to code by using an AI.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting outtake, and it's sort of something that I'd been sort of teetering on the edge with anyway. Is like, no, don't, like, juniors have got to learn the core concepts here before they can go digging in.
Yeah.
And it sort of reinforced that with me that, you know, I'm not the only one who thinks like that. There's lots of other people that do as well.
Yeah, I somewhat agree, but then on the other hand, this is the way forward. Mm. We're not going back, right? This is the way we work now.
Yeah, and look, the one thing I will say is when you've got the ability to explain code blocks as accurately, for the most part, as Gemini does, then maybe it is a good tool to allow a junior to use to get the explanation of a class or a specific function or whatnot, but I'd be very hesitant to just give Gemini to a junior, even in the infrastructure team that I work in, where we're doing predominantly DevOps stuff, and let them loose with Gemini in our Terraform. Because
that's the recipe for disaster.
Yeah, our Terraform's, no, it's not overly complex, but it's complex enough that you've got to understand what you're doing first.
Yep. Well, I'd like to see this canvas, you know, the integration happen a little bit more, maybe with Project IDX, where you can start to import and export between the two. That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
and you have, you know, everything completely web-based and then fully integrated with it. Be nice. Go and check it out. All right. Well, that's going to be about it for this fortnight. Don't forget, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music. Go to Apple Podcasts, write us a review. That will really help the show out. You can go to YouTube and start the discussion. Smash that like button while you're there. That'd be great. And you can contact the show, contact at gcbbytes.com.au, and find us on the web, www.gcbbytes.com.au. And don't forget, today's sponsors are Hivetech Solutions and Mantle Group. Well, I've pretty much said my piece. I'm not going to be here next fortnight, so I'm going to let you guys run the show. This will be an experiment, I tell you what.
Yeah. Boys are back in town.
I'm going to be living my best life on a cruise ship. But send me the files. I'll edit it and make sure the show gets out. That'll be fine.
It's the Dave and Ian show.
Yeah.
Let's be silly.
I'll cue up the goofy music now.
Yeah. Apologies in advance for next fortnight's podcast.
Maybe just skip next fortnight's podcast and just move on to the next one.
Everyone can have a holiday.
I can't wait to hear what you guys create. It's going to be awesome.
I don't know.
All right. Well, that's about it from me. Anything from you guys? I hope not.
No, I'm done.
No. Next fortnight's is going to be interesting.
Yeah.
All right. And we'll see you later. Bye.
Bye.
The tech adventure this morning was Ian's on a new laptop, and when he set it up in a mad dash last Friday when he was in Sydney, didn't put Audacity on it and forgot about it until this morning and got online and went, why can't I find Audacity in the bloody menu?
Wop, wop.
And then went, oh, crap, new laptop. I haven't run Audacity on this. I have no idea if it actually works.
Check that you're like recording the right audio channel and stuff as well.
Yeah. No, I did some tests before I jumped on. I was like, yeah, cool. Okay, good. It's recording the right audio channel. It doesn't sound like a robot. I'm happy with that.